This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When Ned Lamont ran for Senate against Joe Lieberman in 2006, he was tapping into deep discontent over the Iraq War. He didn't quite unseat the longtime senator, but the tough race clearly captured the imagination of the country. Then after another run at elected office, he's back in the business world, and he's got big insights into global policy and also the state budget. Ned Lamont just got back from a trip to Iran, and today Where We Live will ask him about that, talk about what he saw in this enormous booming country as the U.S. tries to negotiate with Iran over its nuclear arms. We'll also talk some national politics as we see Bernie Sanders running as a Democratic outsider, something Ned Lamont knows a little something about. And what does the Fairfield County businessman think about GE's threat to leave Connecticut over proposed tax increases? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Ned Lamont is a businessman. He's a former Democratic candidate for Senate and governor. He also works at Central Connecticut State University in New Britain. He joins us today from the studios of our friends at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Ned Lamont, welcome back to Where We Live. Good to hear from you.
Good morning, John.
First of all, let's talk about your trip to Iran. What took you there?
I'm a member of a business group called YPO, which are folks who have started up their own business. And YPO has an American chapter, and it's also very active in the Middle East. And there used to be a YPO chapter in Iran. It ended more or less with the revolution. And now the YPO chapter is coming back in Tehran. So we were invited by YPO Iran, if you will, and arrived there a few weeks ago. And it was fascinating. The first thing you do when you land at Imam Khomeini Airport, I had taken the Iranian movie Argo off my iPad. I didn't want anything to compromise.
Good move.
I had a long sleeve shirt and long pants, you know, respectful. And you get off the plane, and there's a guy right there. Hello, Mr. Lamont. Welcome to Iran. And that was the beginning of a complex relationship for the next 7 days.
And so in that complex relationship, what were you doing? What sort of conversations were you having on a daily basis?
On a daily basis, we met with all the young entrepreneurs, the business people. We met the Ayatollah in Qom, one of the Ayatollahs. There are many Ayatollahs in Iran. We met with the big business community as well. Really spent as much time as we could talking to the people on the street and the young people. And, you know, two-thirds of Iran is under the age of 35. It's a young, vibrant culture. And the young people, very literate, very well-educated, 95% literacy rate, those folks are very pro-American, and they are desperate to see this deal done. Perhaps the mullahs and the Revolutionary Guard are a different story.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Ned Lamont, who just returned from a trip to Iran a few weeks back, talking about some of the global issues that he's been seeing firsthand, specifically as the U.S. tries to negotiate over Iran's nuclear arms, what we really might know about this country that we probably don't know very much about. One of the people who traveled with you, Saud Anwar, who's been in our program in the past, he's a Pakistani-American, and he's the mayor of South Windsor. He was on the program recently talking about his trip to Iran. Here's what he had to say.
A lot, actually, most of what we hear in the United States about Iran is not accurate. And that was the most stunning thing for us, that it is also a pluralistic society. There are people of all different backgrounds. There are Christians who live there. There are people of Jewish faith who live there in harmony with each other. It's a society which is quite progressive.
A progressive society that Saud Anwar talks about. Is that what you saw, Ned Lamont?
I think when Rouhani was elected, the vast majority of the people in Tehran and the other major cities, I think they are progressive and ready for a change. Their government, the mullahs, the Ayatollah, there's still a dichotomy there, and there's a bit of a tension going on. But I think Mr. Anwar was right when he talked about being a pluralistic society. If the Iranians wanted us to see one thing, they wanted us to see that there are active synagogues in downtown Tehran where folks let it be known they are Jewish and on their way to synagogue, and there was no issue there. They wanted us to see that there are vibrant churches and where Armenian Christians go and can live. They wanted us to see that women drive, women are educated. Most of the women in university, most of the folks in university are women. They even had a female Ayatollah until recently. when she passed away. So they are very quick to say this is not Saudi Arabia. Don't put everybody in the Middle East in one basket.
Mm. And I think it's something that we hear from people around the world. When I had Saud Anwar on the show and we were talking with him and also people from different parts of the world talking about how Americans misperceive, say, Africa or the Middle East or Southeast Asia, one of the things that we always hear from people is that we are not our government. Just as you wouldn't expect someone to meet an American and say, oh, I hate that thing that you did by invading Iraq or something else, we really shouldn't or needn't look at people in Iran as the government that's long led them. But it seems as though that is the perception, certainly, Ned Lamont, of a lot of Americans.
Look, the perception on American TV and American media is, I think, 30 years old. All we read about is death to America, the posters and the chants and, you know, folks in the street. And I think that is a little out of date. There's no question about it. You know, the Revolutionary Guard does tend to stir up some anti-American vitriol on occasion. You know, one of the ambassadors from a European country said, Ned, let me tell you about these spontaneous anti-American riots. We got a call from, the Iranian government. They said there'll be a spontaneous anti-American riot at 10:03 on Thursday morning in front of your embassy. It'll be over within half an hour. Some of this stuff is stage managed. Some of it is left over from Ayatollah Khomeini and what was really a terrible regime soon after the revolution. The question is, how much has it changed in the last 30 years? We saw a lot of change on the streets of Tehran.
So you didn't see the Death to America billboards. You didn't see these spontaneous or not demonstrations on the street. I guess I'm wondering, who are they doing that for? I mean, who's the audience for the Death to America billboard that pops up or the anti-American demonstration that is promptly scheduled for 10:03?
I think the audience is still the fact that the mullahs and the Revolutionary Guard need an enemy. And no question about it, all the emotion and vitriol is directed at Saudi Arabia. And, Shia Iran is convinced that Sunni Saudi, aided and abetted by Iraq and maybe even aided and abetted by the United States, is out to get them. So they do need an enemy. And I think in terms of the sanctions regime, the mullahs ironically sort of profit off of the sanctions regime. We have a strict sanctions regime that's meant to punish the people who were doing wrong in Iran, and it tends to enrich them. So there are a lot of complex ebbs and flows when it comes to that relationship. But I would tell you, John, that for every old Death to America billboard you see there, you see a Torno ad, watch ad. You see a lot of posters memorializing the young men who died in the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. You see that on every street corner. And it's a way for the mullahs to remind people we live in an island where a lot of people are out to get us. They feed that paranoia.
In a piece that you wrote that we read in Real Clear Politics upon your return, you wrote, Iran is an indoor-outdoor split personality. Outdoor public displays of affection are frowned upon. Alcohol is banned. Headscarves are required. Pools and beaches are segregated. If outdoor culture in Tehran seems somewhere between Utah and Saudi Arabia, the indoor culture can veer toward Las Vegas. Indoors, the chador gives way to the latest in European fashions. The wine flows. Pools are being built. Taylor Swift is a hit, and many women have bandages on their noses since Iran is the rhinoplasty capital of the Middle East. It sounds for a businessman, Ned Lamont, like, well, Iran might be a market to get into for Americans.
Iran, before the revolution, had an economy, I was told, bigger than Eastern Europe. First thing you do when you go into the hotel, the Parzian Azadi Hotel, is you see hundreds of business people from around the world, Turks, Germans, Russians, Chinese, everybody doing business, everybody except for the United States of America. We are honoring the sanctions, so we're going to pull back and see whether there's a real change. But and secondly, you do see many, many women with bandages on their nose because Iran is the nose job capital of the Middle East, and folks from throughout the region come there for a whole variety of different cosmetic surgery. So there is an indoor-outdoor culture, though. I mean, if outdoor you're wearing a headscarf, it's not a very religious, very, you know, it's more, Jackie Kennedy than, burqa. But there are some standards that are kept. But you walk around, you know, Dara Park, and there are lots of young people walking hand in hand. It's you could mistake it for Central Park pretty quickly. But once you get inside to those private party, you know, there Michael Jackson is playing, liquor is flowing, and people are. You might as well be in Fairfield County, Connecticut.
I was gonna say, sounds an awful lot like Greenwich to me. Hey, but here's the thing, Ned, and this is interesting. Almost everything you're saying sounds an awful lot like post-U.S. invasion Baghdad. We heard an awful lot about a modern culture in Iraq with women walking around in short skirts and people living a fairly modern lifestyle, of course, under a terrible dictator in Saddam Hussein. Do you draw some parallels between the Iraq, you know, pre-U.S. invasion, pre-9/11, and the Tehran that you were visiting just this year?
That's a very good question. And the risk is, can Iran go back again? Can Iran, you know, they made a great deal of progress from our point of view during the 90s. And then President George W. Bush said Iran is part of the axis of evil, and all negotiations and diplomacy between our two countries stopped, and a guy named Ahmadinejad was elected in Iran, and they turned the clock back in a serious way. And he drove the country into the ditch. The sanctions were a big part of that, I might say. And a guy named Rouhani was elected, despite the Ayatollahs, who had other people they favored. They had an election, and this guy was elected. And it has led to a real liberalizing of, you know, Tehran and the other cities. I mean, one of the things Rouhani was elected on was he said, I'm going to upgrade the 3G Internet service. And you say, well, what's that about? Facebook is outlawed in Iran. No, it's not. There are 15 million young people on Facebook. Maybe they use their ID address from Abu Dhabi, but everybody is on Facebook. Everybody is trying to start up the next Groupon, trying to start up, you know, the next Airbnb. So can it turn back? There's always a risk. I think one of the reasons that if this deal falls and collapses and Iran goes back, it could be a return to that old regime.
And we'll talk about the deal in just a moment. We're talking today with Ned Lamont, of course, the Fairfield County businessman, former Democratic candidate for Senate and governor here in the state. He's joined us numerous times to talk about state and global policy on the program. And if you want to join us with some of your questions, we'll take them in a moment at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Before we get to the deal that's being negotiated between the U.S. and Iran over its nuclear arms, what do you see as the impact of the sanctions that have been levied against the country for all these years, if indeed it's a modern country in which people, at least behind closed doors, are doing Facebook and in the lobby of the big hotel, people are doing business deals? Are these sanctions taking hold? Are they having some impact on the people of Iran?
Well, we're on our way to the airport that first night, and I didn't know what. I thought it might be like Havana, you know, another, you know, Cuba with the sanctions and a bunch of 1957 Chevys spewing black smoke. And there on the road into the main town, you see dozens of convertibles and Porsches and international cars. In fact, a group went by with the top down and people singing and chanting, and libations may have been involved, and it was a wedding party. And I just thought, okay, this is not your father's Iran. You know, you go into the hotel and you sit down, and I didn't know what I could order, so I said I'd like to have a cola, something that would wake me up, and Coke or Pepsi. And I didn't realize the sanctions aren't leaky, but there are a lot of workarounds there, and you can get almost all the major American products that you want. I would say the one place you really see the sanctions biting, John, is when it comes to the financial controls. There are hundreds of half-built buildings, as far as the eye can see, because there's really no such thing as bank financing. And that's one place where I think the regime is desperate to see the sanctions regime relaxed.
Mm. So the deadline at the end of this month to reach a nuclear deal with Iran, what do you hope to see in this deal? Obviously, there's been a lot of barking in Congress about how the U.S., from their standpoint, many Republicans say, shouldn't be involved in these negotiations. There's some worry that the negotiations are going to give away too much to this country that has in many ways held the U.S. and some of its allies hostage with their threats of arming themselves with nuclear weapons. What do you hope to see out of this deal, Ned?
I would tell you that it's not a deal between the United States and Iran. It's a deal between the world community and Iran. And the P5 plus one, which is Europe and China and Russia, they are on board with this framework agreement. Unless Iran tries to retrade any of the framework deals, I believe that Europe and Russia and China and India and the rest of the world community are going to be actively involved economically in Iran, and would be the United States that is isolated, not Iran at that point. In terms of where I'd be on the deal, two things. I think the sanctions regime is already unraveling. So if I was going to compromise at all, I think I'd compromise in terms of how you phase in the sanctions relief, because it's already phasing in. And believe me, the Americans are going to be very slow to put real money there just because there's too much risk. I would be very strict on the inspections regime. You know, like I said, John, it's sort of a workaround economy. They know how to, you know, carve around the edges of the rules. I think it's very important that you have real intrusive inspections, including the military bases, so we have some confidence that what we bargain for is happening.
I want to get to some phone calls and some tweets and emails if you want to join the conversation about Iran with Ned Lamont. He just returned from that country. Paul is calling from Hartford. Hello, Paul. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Lamont, when you were in Iran, did you bring up with the leaders of Iran or with the people you spoke to in Iran how offensive their anti-Semitism is, their denial of the Holocaust, as well as their threats to annihilate America's allies, the State of Israel?
Paul, thank you for your question. Go ahead, Ned, and thank you, Paul, very much.
Hey, Paul, we absolutely brought that up. We brought that up with the Ayatollah we met with in Qom, which is the religious center, and we said the reason this whole deal is jeopardized because of the vitriol we hear from some of your leaders when it comes to Israel. You know, their response was thin, but it went along these lines. That was Ahmadinejad. You don't hear that from Rouhani and the new government. And we say we haven't heard anything positive from Rouhani and the new government either. At least say that was the old regime, not the new regime. The other response they would have was we have problems with Israel's foreign policy, especially as regards the Palestinians. We don't have problems with Jews. Look at our own country. And neither answer was satisfactory. But, Paul, I can tell you we brought it up wherever we went. And I think it's very important the United States continue to make that push.
But that's also, I think, why it's important for you to bring up this nuclear deal with Iran really is meant to be a multinational effort. And none of these things can be seen in a vacuum, right? You can't really divorce Israel and the Palestinians, the Gaza Strip and the problems there from what's happening with the U.S. and Iran right now. Those things are just, you know, intrinsically linked together, aren't they, Ned?
They definitely Iran sees those all as intrinsically linked. But as I said before, if I saw vitriol and emotion in terms of their hatreds, it's really towards Saudi. That's where they see the existential war. When it comes to Israel, I got a sense that they feel like if they can wait out Netanyahu, maybe things can change. Remember that Iran and Israel had a very close relationship up until the revolution in 1980. Daily flights back and forth. Iran was one of Israel's greatest allies. Whether that ever happens again, we'll see. But anti-Semitism is not deeply rooted in the culture. I think the politics is.
One last question for you before we take a break. We got a tweet from Garrett here who says, I think we're getting a good picture of wealthy Iran, but 55% of the country is below the poverty line. I don't know those numbers myself, but there is a sense, Ned Lamont, that you or an American businessman or an American business group might see a slightly different picture than the Iran that lurks beneath the surface.
You know, I think that's true. I think that's probably true of every single culture, but absolutely. But I would say that the poor are not as poor as they are in the United States in the sense of income disparity, that the poor in Iran tend to be better educated and have some opportunities. We got to Isfahan and Shiraz and other cities, but we didn't get to the countryside, which is poor and more religious and more likely to support the next Ahmadinejad. So I think Garrett's warning is well taken.
We're talking to Ned Lamont. He's a businessman, former Democratic candidate for Senate and governor in Connecticut. He's also an instructor, a teacher at CCSU, Central Connecticut State University. We've worked together for years, and he's been on our program talking about global issues and the state budget many times. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about some national politics. We're also going to talk about the budget deal here in the state of Connecticut. If you have thoughts or questions for Ned Lamond on any of these subjects, including his trip to Iran, 860-275-7266. You can also tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're visiting with Ned Lamond. He's a Fairfield County businessman, former Democratic candidate for Senate and governor. He also is an instructor at Central Connecticut State University, where he leads interesting discussions about politics. He's talked with us a number of times about global politics and also the state budget. If you have questions and thoughts for him about his recent trip to Iran or any of these other issues, 860-275-7266. He joins us today from the studios of our friends at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Bringing this somewhat back to your trip to Iran, you know, many people first heard of Ned Lamond during your 2006 run against Joe Lieberman. That campaign was really predicated in the idea that the Iraq war needed to end. It was a war that Senator Lieberman strongly supported, and you nearly unseated him around that issue. As you look back at what has happened in that region, in Iraq and Syria, these many years later, specifically the rise of ISIS, is this something that you potentially saw coming, this terrible new group that fills a vacuum after the invasion of U.S. troops into Iraq and the new government that was installed there? Did you see ISIS or ISIL coming?
I sure didn't see ISIS or ISIL coming, but I did worry that when you knock over a strong man, you kick over a hornet's nest, and we had no plan for what happened afterwards. And I think to this day, it was an enormous strategic blunder that hurts our position in the Middle East and did nothing for the people of Iraq. But now it's, 7 years later. And while it was easy to rally folks and young people against an unpopular war, and one of the reasons I'm outspoken on trying to find a diplomatic solution to some of these problems in the Middle East, starting with Iran, it's tougher to rally people behind that. But I think that is where our future's got to be. When it comes to Iraq, what do you do now? You've got the Kurds in the north. You've got the Sunnis in Anbar province. Those are both our allies who are willing to take the lead, and I think we should be supporting them. But by no means do you want the American troops at the front of that troop line.
It's interesting when you talk about the way the U.S., whether it's publicly in political speech or whether it's backroom negotiations, the way the U.S. deals with Iran, it seems as though it should be, Ned, influenced somewhat, informed somewhat by what we've seen over the course of these last couple decades. We knock over a strongman in Saddam Hussein, and what floods in is Bashar al-Assad is now at war inside his country. You see the elements that are flowing in. Egypt and Libya, the same thing. It almost seems as though the strongman that you know is at least something that you can deal with. I don't know if that informs the way we might have ongoing negotiations with Iran, but over and over again, it seems as though when the top topples, bad things have not flowed into that region.
We let Mubarak go. He was not a good guy in Egypt, but if things gotten better there, the popular elected guy that replaced him, Morsi, is on the death watch at this point. Libya, I mean, my God, Gaddafi was a madman, but he had made an agreement with the United States to get rid of the weapons of mass destruction. And 5 years later, he is toppled. America is right in the middle of that event. And now you have a terrorist state right on Europe's border. And I think you should think very carefully about Syria in terms of how you want that to play out. Do you really want Assad to go overnight, or do you want somebody who can stand up and fight ISIS?
But what does this teach us about the way that we negotiate with countries like Iran in the future? I mean, we clearly can't have regimes that are going to cause problems or threaten our allies. As our caller Paul said earlier, we can't have an Iran that threatens the destruction of Israel a few countries away. But at the same time, as you said, we haven't done a very good job of figuring out what's going to come in next and fill that vacuum. I mean, at this point, if you're directing or at least advising U.S. foreign policy, what do we do?
You've got to take a longer picture. Remember that Iran was Israel's closest ally for many decades in the Middle East. Remember that Iran and the United States were working very closely to take down the Taliban and work with the Northern Alliance just 12 years ago. These are not immutable forces that are forever in conflict. So you need really strong hands-on diplomacy working to find where that common ground is. And I do believe that some common ground with Iran, and I do believe that that should open the door to better relations with Israel as well.
You know, one of the things that obviously caused a huge problem for the United States' involvement with Iraq and the war that you opposed publicly when you ran against Joe Lieberman was the lack of information that we had about what was really going on in Iran. Obviously, we got bad information, or we were given bad information about weapons of mass destruction. I use that all as a segue to say, when we read about, say, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership that the Obama administration is pushing fast-track authority on, that is seemingly roundly being booed by those on both sides of the aisle, mostly because they just don't know what's in there. It is being touted as a huge business deal for America that may indeed be a giveaway to big American corporations, but we can't see the details. That lack of transparency, Ned Lamont, is seemingly one of the things that got us into trouble in Iraq. Might it get us into trouble in something like a trade deal overseas?
We know so little about our adversaries and even our allies around the rest of the world. One last thing on Iran. When we shut down the embassy, we didn't punish them. We punished ourselves. We turned out the lights. We had to rely upon others to have some idea of what's going on in Iran. And obviously, we had no clue what we were doing when we went into Iraq. You know, TPP and other type of international deals. Look, the Americans have a lot of skepticism, and I felt a lot of that when I was running against Joe some years ago about our engagement in the rest of the world and whether we should retrench and invest in America first. So I think it really behooves the president and his allies, and I'd like to see Hillary Clinton stand up and say why this deal is important and what safeguards there are for working people in Connecticut and beyond. They've got a lot of selling to do on this thing, but I can also see why it could be important and positive for this country if we got it right.
You're asking Hillary Clinton to speak up about it a little bit. Maybe we can talk about national politics. We see a clear front runner in Hillary Clinton and the Democratic side. You're a Democrat who's run both as a Senate candidate and also a gubernatorial candidate. When you see a candidate like Hillary Clinton being almost anointed as the choice for Democrats, when you have as many as, 20 different people running for the Republican nomination, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing for the Democratic Party?
I don't think it's a good thing at all for the Democratic Party. I think a good, feisty challenge is just what she needs. She'll be a better candidate for him. She'll be forced to, really articulate issues under some crossfire. You know, you got Bernie Sanders going to go after her on a TPP. Let's hear what you have to say. You have others say, look, I think the Iran deal is important. You can't, can't take a wait and see attitude. At some point, we want to see where your instincts are in these issues. So, yeah, I think it's a good thing to have new people, go in and challenge. At the end of the day, I think she's an extremely competent candidate and could be an extremely competent president.
Do you think that Bernie Sanders actually being in the race and maybe Elizabeth Warren being outside the race but raising some of the same issues, do you think it actually does change her position somewhat? Do you think it has Hillary Clinton addressing things like TPP and maybe moving slightly to the left?
Like, I don't think you have to trim your sails just because you've got a challenge, but it does make you stand up and articulate where you stand and why you're there. Same thing with Rand Paul in the Republican Party. I like having the Bernie Sanders and Rand Pauls of this world in a primary. That's why you have primaries. Go in there, challenge conventional thinking from the left or the right or just an unorthodox point of view, and make your incumbents or make your front runners defend themselves and articulate.
Mm. Back in 2008, you were chairman of Barack Obama's campaign in Connecticut. Has the president lived up to your hopes?
Look, I think I may be one of the president's the last great defenders, but I would say that he really has. In terms of the big issues confronting our country, the first one was the incredible economic collapse, and we had a decision to make. Austerity versus a stimulus plan. I think he got that right. Our economy is 15% bigger than it was at the time of the crash. Europe is smaller than it was at the time of the crash. I think we got that right. When it comes to a foreign policy, he definitely changed the way we deal with the rest of the world. And I know there's a lot of pushback about whether we pulled out of Iraq too soon, but I think at the end of the day, I think history will show that he made a lot of important decisions. He didn't withdraw from the world. Look at the TPP. Look at the Iran deal. It's active engagement with the rest of the world, but just in a different way. And I think on healthcare, if we continue to bring down costs and we continue to expand the number of people who have insurance, that may be a leading part of his legacy as well.
But I'm
okay with Barack.
Yeah, the pushback that a lot of people would have, though, we also saw an expansion of the surveillance of U.S. citizens. We saw this lack of transparency about the way in which business is done that I talked about earlier. Things like a promise to close Guantanamo Bay that was never kept and has actually helped to energize groups like ISIS. Some of these things that Barack Obama hasn't done that perhaps people had hoped he'd done, maybe a part of his legacy as well, don't you think?
No. I mean, Guantanamo, we were all set. We were going to redirect those people to a prison in the United States of America where there would have been some sort of due process. And the Congress said, no, we're not going to allow these guys to come to the United States. So you had to offshore them elsewhere. And that's taken a little bit of time.
We're talking about that.
Go ahead. Yeah. The Patriot Act was, I think, a really severe overreaction following 9/11. And I think the metadata is an incredible intrusion into our personal lives, and we don't want government with that much power. That said, I think they've got an act that's coming out of Congress right now that's probably a reasonable compromise that puts real limits on the metadata, which targets innocents as well as terrorists, and puts in place some judicial oversight. I think we're getting it right.
Ned Lamont joins us today on the program talking a bit about foreign policy and national politics. When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking about the state budget. Just yesterday, down in Fairfield County, GE, the state's biggest employer, said they're not happy with this tax deal that Governor Malloy and state Democrats reached. They're talking about, well, maybe they don't need to have so many jobs in Connecticut. What does Ned Lamont think about the new tax plan or the state budget? You can join us with your questions, 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the clock is ticking on the end of the state legislative session. That time of year when reporters and Capitol observers try to make sense of what's happening, what legislation will get passed, what will get killed, and what gets moved to the next budget implementer. You can join us for our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, here on Where We Live. I hope you can join us. And thanks to all of those of you who joined us last night at The Wheelhouse Uncensored, a really fun evening with Colin McEnroe and some other Wheelhouse regulars. Thanks again to everyone here who made it possible. Today in the program, we're talking with Ned Lamont. He's a Fairfield County businessman. He's former Democratic candidate for Senate and governor. He just returned from a trip to Iran. He's been talking about Iran and foreign policy, a bit about national politics. We'll take some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 in just a moment. But since we're talking about the state budget, Ned Lamont, boy, a lot of news coming out of Hartford. It seems as though the governor and legislative leaders struck a deal over the weekend. It hits the light of day on Monday, and it doesn't seem like anybody's happy about it. What's your take?
You can't do this every 2 years. What I hear from rich guys in Fairfield County, what I hear from public sector workers in the state is that, look, 2 years ago, 4 years ago, we did our bit. We took higher taxes. We had some givebacks on the labor front. We thought we had finally solved the issue. And what's killing us is that we never solve it. And every 2 years, we go through this same paroxysm again. And that's why you have the business community, because they pay the brunt of this latest round in this current budget, making these noises. But look, they're not just making noises. Pfizer is already hollowed out. Aetna is hollowing out. UBS and RBS, the two banks down in our neck of the woods. So I'm not shocked to hear, you know, GE and, you know, some of the others worry. There's a trend line that is negative, and we haven't solved it.
Okay, so help us solve it. What is the thing, the structural thing that has to change so that we don't have the cycle where every 2 years we're back with our hands out asking for more money both from state workers and also more money from the taxpayers, more money from businesses? How do we solve this?
Well, 4 years ago, we had a strong activist governor who had just been elected, a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, and a crisis, a real fiscal crisis. And that was labor agreed to open up their labor agreement. The taxpayers knew that they were going to be at the table. And that was a time for us to dig a lot deeper than we did, make the structural changes necessary, both on the taxes and on the labor side, to get this thing solved in a way that we'd be talking about what taxes we reduce now. That's what's going on in other states, you know, New York, California, and what we can do on labor. Instead, we tend to we hit our social services, and they pay the brunt of the spending cuts, which I think is terrible in terms of what we do for our safety net. And we're raising taxes on a business, and let's face it, they have itchy feet right now.
But the cuts you're saying are going to be deep. The social service cuts, you know, there's almost no chance that we're going to be able to fund some of these programs the way we have in the past because of this crisis. Are you saying that when we had the big fiscal crisis, when Dan Malloy took office, that we needed to dig deeper, meaning more cuts elsewhere in state government, maybe deeper cuts around the state employees contract, a bigger tax increase at the time? The money's got to come from somewhere. What should we have done?
Just that.
Yeah,
I think I would have done more on the labor concessions, and I think I would have done more when it comes to high-income taxpayers. What both of these folks can't stand is the fact that every 2 years we go through this, and it's that uncertainty and those paroxysms of pain. It would be the mix of taxes and spending is less concerning than the fact that we go through this every 2 years. And it's that uncertainty that means I'm not going to locate my business here. It's that uncertainty that means the state of Connecticut has to pay you to keep your business here. And that's a cycle. Look, Weicker did it back in the early 90s. He's the last governor to actually cut spending. And you may think of him as the guy that did the income tax, but he put in place a budget that lasted for a long period of time. And if we could do one thing to change the course, it would be a budget that ends the structural deficit.
And that's key, Ned Lamont. We talk about uncertainty an awful lot when we mention the business community. Often, business groups, business lobby groups will say it's all about the tax rate or the corporate tax rate. And if the rate is too high, then we're going to move elsewhere. But it's not necessarily about the tax rate, either for individuals or for businesses. It's about knowing that you're going to have a certain type of business structural tax over the course of the next couple of years. You can make plans even in a high tax state, but you can't make plans if there's all this uncertainty.
Yeah, John, that's absolutely right. I have a 5-year business plan. I take it out to my investors. All of a sudden, and it's predicated on some things. It's predicated on a certain tax rate. It's predicated on what we're going to do on education and infrastructure as well. There's some assumptions you make. And when you break your word to the taxpayer, when you break your word to labor, when you break your word to the business community time and again, that creates a certain paralysis.
So what do we do about companies like General Electric when they say, we don't like the tax deal that was just proposed, and if it passes, we may seriously think about taking some of these thousands of jobs out of the state? This is something that we've heard over and over again from businesses, whether it's we don't like the tax deal, we might leave, or give us a tax break from the First Five plan or somewhere else, or we'll leave. At a certain point, Ned Lamont, doesn't the government have to stand up somewhat to the business interests here and say, look, you can't just threaten us to go every time things start to turn bad. We're a partner in this. I mean, what's the better way to approach the business community? Because it seems like we keep getting held up with these threats.
Imagine if GE put just 10% of their capital spending into the state where their headquarters are. I mean, these guys are already moving. They're moving maybe not their actual corporate headquarters, but the jobs and the high-end manufacturing and a lot of the opportunities. Look at Hartford. We hollowed out our insurance industry there. So this is already happening. These are not just idle threats and they're putting a gun to our head. And I don't think the business community is impressed when you say, hey, look, we're going to give you a special tax credit if you promise to stick around a little bit. They want to see long-term fundamental changes with some some stability that you see there.
But they may not be impressed, but we keep giving them away. When the opportunity arises to give a couple million dollars to somebody to relocate from one town to another, moving a big headquarters of a hedge fund to Stamford, which then gets scuttled, it seems as though maybe this isn't what's going to keep the companies around, Ned, but it certainly is what we're offering all the time.
And imagine the other 90% of the businesses in this state that pay a corporate income tax surcharge so you can subsidize that guy that threatened to leave. Unfortunately, it's now not the exception. It's the rule that you go to the state of Connecticut and say, give me a Benny or I may move. And that's not a winning formula for this state. What do you do now, though? Okay, that's 4 years ago. Here we are today. Look, they've negotiated a budget. My hunch is you probably ought to go with something pretty close to what we got. I don't think this is the time to open up all the negotiations again and put us through a long, bloody summer of back and forth. But you're going to have to give GE and the rest of the business community some sense that we've learned and we're going to fundamentally restructure our tax and spending policies over the next couple years, or else they will have one foot out the door.
A lot of people want to join our conversations, like Chris in Stamford. Hi there, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to make a comment. You know, I live in Richfield. I work in Stamford. I work for a major manufacturer in the beauty space. And, you know, raising taxes further on companies that can be mobile and change states and locations at any moment, especially when you have incentives coming out of North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, Florida. Why would any company stay in Connecticut when the threat is for higher corporate tax, not to mention higher personal taxes and higher property taxes? Instead of looking at raising revenues to solve our fiscal crisis, why don't we look at the true problem? A pension benefit structure for our state employees that is outdated, antiquated, and not in line with what you see in the private sector. And I say this as someone who voted for President Obama twice, but for the first time ever, I'll be voting Republican, and so will a lot of other people that I know, because it's not sustainable. Thank you very much.
Chris, thank you very much. Ned Lamont, a reaction to Chris?
I'm afraid Chris is right on what he says. Look, as I said, 4 years ago, we opened up those labor agreements. That was the time to take a look at where we were, and we didn't make the changes. We made progress, John. We made progress, but not enough to make a difference. I'd say one thing on behalf of the public sector employees: they entered into a contract with the state of Connecticut many years ago that included some pension and health care. So when you're asking people to give back, you know, keep that in mind. And I'll tell you one other thing. I mean, a lot of it is the high cost of our pension expenses. But if we had had the same performance, if the Connecticut State Pension Fund had had the same performance as, say, David Swensen did at Yale University with the endowment, we wouldn't have a shortfall now. So it's not all in the backs of the public sector employees, but they're going to have to be part of the solution.
But there's a political calculation here too, Ned Lamont. If you had been elected governor and not Dan Malloy, you would have been elected in large part because public sector employees and other unions would have gotten strongly behind you. And it's really hard to cut deeply into what those folks and their kids are going to be making over the course of the next couple decades after you just won an election.
What's your question there? If you have the support of the public sector unions, it's pretty tough to go back and ask them to give something. I turn that on its back, though. I mean, Dan had strong support from the public sector unions in our primary, and certainly in his race with Tom Foley. And sometimes it takes a friend to go in there and make the changes you need. And I think Dan was in a very strong position to say, look, public sector employees, we're not going to balance the budget on your back. The rich people and others are going to have to contribute to what we're doing in the state of Connecticut, but you're going to have to be part of the solution. And I think you could have pushed a little harder.
I'm so used to having a free-flowing dialogue with you, Ned, I forget to ask questions sometimes. We've got a few minutes here left in the program. Actually, you know, our last caller who said he's voted Democrat for years and he may be voting Republican this time, it leads me to one tactical thing that has come up during this session is whether or not A state that is run by a democratically controlled legislature and a democratic governor, and all the state office holders are Democrats, and even the state congressional delegation is Democrats. If maybe, you know, inviting some Republicans into the room to help negotiate a budget deal might actually help things. I mean, I know it's a hard thing for partisans to want to do, but do you think that maybe listening to some more conservative voices as part of this conversation might help things?
Look, I think that's part of the solution. But look, I ran for office. I looked at for those really great solutions from the Republicans. I looked at their playbook. I said, okay, where can you get some good strategic cuts that'll make a difference? And their playbook was pretty empty. And they'll go into that closed-door session. And they'll say, we're going to balance the budget on the back of the public sector employees. So at the end of the day, it's very important that the governor get folks together, and it's very important that he finds some common ground between those two points of view. But at the end of the day, I think he's going to push through with a budget like this. I'd ask the governor to do one other thing. I mean, I think he's been very good, John, on education. He has held it harmless in terms of this tough budget crisis, but he's not endorsing the status quo. He's also supported some real reforms. And another place where I really would urge him to get folks together is get some of the reformers and get the teachers together so we can find what common ground there is to put forward some of the reforms that he has tied his legacy to, which is important. We need him to take a very activist role there.
And in the budget negotiations, he made sure that there was some money for charter school expansion. I know you've been very involved in education reform over the years, Ned Lamont. That thing is something that drives a little bit of a wedge between many teachers who worry that more charter school funding is going to threaten the schools that maybe need a little bit more funding. How do you handle that balance, innovating on one end, but also making sure that the everyday public schools get the funding that they need?
Look, I think you're devoted to public education, and you're going to make real reforms to improve the quality of public education and community schools. And charter schools are fine. They did a good example of working together with unions and the administration in New Haven some years ago. But it's not the answer to how we're going to push our state forward. And so, to me, my priority would be better teacher training, getting them more comfortable with the Common Core, upgrading the standards, and reminding folks that we need and respect our teachers and do everything we can to make that a profession where young people want to be. Look, I'm up at CCSU pointed out, we have fewer applicants to the teachers' college than we've had in years. The best and the brightest are not necessarily going into teaching right now. You can have all the reforms and all the charter schools you want. Unless you make teaching a profession where the best and the brightest want to be and they're respected, we're going to lose.
We just have a couple minutes left, Ned, actually about a minute and a half. We got this tweet from Peter who says, great interview on where we live. Is it time to get back in the ring? Do you ever talk about this? You think about getting back into politics?
I don't think I quite fit. For me, a Democratic primary is tough. You can see I've sort of alienated a few core groups there. And obviously on the Republican side, I'm not ideal. But as you can see, I stay very involved in it. It's a little frustrating sitting, you know, doing the new media and cable TV in Greenwich, Connecticut, when I see our state and the world are hurt and what's going on in Hartford. So you never say never, but I think it's pretty tough, and I think Annie is pretty happy what she's doing.
Mm-hmm. And you bring that up. I'll just ask you 30 seconds here. There's probably a lot that we up here in Hartford don't really understand about what's happening in Fairfield County, whether it's with the business climate or how people are viewing the world. Just give us 30 seconds on that, Ned. What don't we get about Fairfield County up here that maybe we should?
I think Fairfield County, many of the folks, especially the high-end folks, they work in and around New York. They sometimes think that Andrew Cuomo is their governor, and they don't hear much from the state of Connecticut until it's tax time. And it's really important to show Fairfield County how education and infrastructure and transportation are key to their future as well, and get them back as part of the state. So that's why you got to get a new show down here in Fairfield County, John Dankosky, that reminds these people what's going on in Hartford matters.
We'll have to talk after the show about new ways to do that. Ned Lamont is, of course, head of Lamont Digital Systems. He's a businessman, former Democratic candidate for Senate and governor in our state. He recently returned from a trip to Iran. He's also a visiting lecturer at Central Connecticut State University. Ned, always good to speak with you. Thank you so much.
See you at CCSU.
And thanks very much to our friends at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut for hosting our program today. Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kion Wolf produce our show. The digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. This is Where We Live.